Whatever it is, those are check boxes. That's a bad way to evaluate people. We are far too complicated. Like, I'll give you an example, a bachelor's degree. The reason people look for it is because what they really want is they want the tenacity and the resilience. They want somebody who's going to stick with something. Mm-hmm. They want somebody who's reasonably intelligent. And maybe they want somebody who can write. None of that, you can have all of that and not have a bachelor's degree. So you're right. So check boxes does make you miss out, I think. And it narrows the aperture. The more this, now I like to use dating as an example. The more things you have on your list for must-haves for that person, the less likely you are to find somebody. Because, you know, they might have, let's say you've got five. They might have four, but not the fifth. Or three, they might be really great at three, and then two, they suck at it. It's horrible.
Hey, Jonathan Kleck here with another episode of the Greencastle Podcast. I'm excited today. Today we have on Dr. Josh Cotton. This guy, check this out. This Josh has a PhD in organizational psychology. He took that education and he took it to the SEAL teams where the Navy was saying, hey, we have, for every 100 guys we put into SEAL training, we lose 85% of them. That's a highly inefficient business model. How do we increase it? How do we increase our graduation rate without lowering the standards? Josh went in, did a ton of studying, and just introduced some really cool tools to help the SEALs teams be better in their recruiting, identifying who's going to be the best performers. Now he's taking that out to the private sector, and he's helping organizations identify who's going to be your top performers before you waste money on bringing in 100 people, only 85 of them end up quitting after a year or two. So we're excited to talk to Josh. Wealth of knowledge, super funny and entertaining guy. Stick around. You're going to like this one.
This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap.
There's a reason why.
A master of innovation.
The key to this growing is you.
Any rational person would give up.
I can't disagree with that.
Make sure that we're not prisoners of our own experiences.
You need a team of great people.
We'll not tolerate a loser.
What they need is a common vision.
Helping organizations win, one veteran at a time. This is the Greencastle Podcast.
Hey, Josh, thanks very much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time and appreciate you coming on, man. You've got a fascinating background and a fascinating story. So thanks for making time for us today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really happy to be here.
Before we start, why don't you tell us a little bit about, well, I mean, you ended up here because you have a book coming out. We obviously have a connection. You spent a lot of time working with the SEAL teams, and we have, you know, our company's founded by a SEAL, and we have some SEALs working for us, yours truly notwithstanding. But you really have a fascinating background on what you've done with the military and what you've done in leadership and things like that. So if you want to just take 10 seconds and just give us a quick rundown of who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Actually, thanks for calling it fascinating. It's definitely unique and unusual. I have a PhD in a field called industrial organizational psychology, and I discovered this field a little after college and when I was lost and thinking about what did I want to do with the rest of my life. And once I discovered it, I was enthralled because it's essentially taking psychology and applying it to the business world, applying it to people's work and employment and trying to make organizations better from a people standpoint. And the school that I ended up going to is co-located with the head of personnel for the US Navy. And because of that, I had an opportunity in school to go work with the Navy. And because of that, it turned into a job with the Navy as a civilian. And I ended up working, including a contractor year, I ended up working 6 years with the Navy. And the last half of that, 3.5 years, I was working directly with the US Navy SEALs doing IO psychology, but with the Navy SEALs. And if you're somebody like me in IO psychology who's trying to help organizations hire better employees, I can't think of a better place to do it than helping the Navy SEALs hire better SEALs or better people, really, for BUDS was their target. But that led to a whole lot of different experiences. And after the 6 years with the Navy, Fortune 500 world. So I've worked with multiple Fortune 500s, again, helping them do the same thing, screen job applicants. So I have knowledge from both of these worlds that, of course, I blend. And these, they don't know it, but the Fortune 500s are getting the advice of what I saw working with Navy SEALs and other special operators.
So are you just telling Fortune 500 companies to have like to bring in like 10 candidates, put them in cold water, and whoever lasts the longest, that's who you hire? Because that's essentially the I'm whittling the BUD screening process down to its most elementary form.
Cold, wet, and sandy, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, is that all you do? Just yeah.
I want to be
a design engineer at I want to work for DuPont. Just go have 10 of them go stand out in the cold water. Whoever lasts, that's who you hire.
If you've ever been through a Fortune 500 screening process, it's nothing even close to testing anything like that. It's like 8 interviews. That's how they do it. And so they have a whole lot of room to grow.
8 interviews. Well, it's the same thing. Actually, for some of us, actually sitting through 8 interviews might be more painful than sitting in the cold water for 8 hours.
True. Because they'll ask the same thing. Like, you know, you get a lot of practice answering those questions, I suppose.
But tell me about a time you know what? I'm just going to go lay out in the ocean and just let the crabs eat at me. I'm good.
Exactly.
So, I know you've got a lot of diverse experiences and you've been helping veterans and veterans with transition. And I know you've written a couple articles about veteran transition and you have a book coming out focused on hiring practices. And I read somewhere in your bio that you've helped screen over 100,000 applicants. But shamelessly, coming from the SEAL teams, I'm fascinated because they've had, I mean, from the time I went through 25 years ago, they've had, and even before that, they had dozens of psychologists and organizations come through and everybody trying to help the Navy understand who it is that makes it through BUDS, right? Because if you have a 15% attrition rate, and to be clear, I've always argued that it's not a 15% attrition rate. It is an 85% attrition rate. It is a much greater than that because you have, I think it's 1 out of only every 10 guys that even applies gets in because they only take the top 10% who even get in. And then 85% of them attrit out. So so while SEALs have pride in the fact that we are, you know, we're a very selective bunch and we've been through a number of screening processes where ultimately we end up being at a very, a microcosm of the greater applicant pool. The interesting thing is if you're in the Navy, and I'm not telling anything you don't know, but if you're in the Navy, you go, well, it takes money and time and energy and manpower resources to send 100 guys to BUDS to only have a 15% graduation rate. If I was a congressman or a senior leader who didn't understand necessarily the nuances of BUDS, I might also say that's a terribly inefficient business model. If McDonald's or IBM fired 85% of their people that they hired after only 3 months, you would say that's a terrible business model. So I'm really fascinated at some of the lessons you learned coming in and helping the Navy go, all right, it is a terribly inefficient business model, but maybe here are some of the challenges. And I wonder if you can just kind of give us a quick snapshot as we dig into this.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So much to say. So first of all, the congressman did say that. I think it was, I don't know exactly when, maybe it was 2005, 2006, 2007. So it's after September 11th. The soft community's value has been elevated. And really, the Navy essentially couldn't make enough SEALs. They were missing their quotas. They were missing their targets. And
to be clear, just the one thing about the SEAL teams is there's only one pipeline to get into the SEALs. You can't transfer from the Army Rangers and then just you just magically ominous be a SEAL. You have to come through BUD. So there is there's a funnel that's and I'm sorry for cutting you off, but that is something that, you know, as people try and look and they go, well, how do we replicate? How do we make more SEALs? Well, unfortunately, there's a choke point, right? Everybody bottlenecks through that one screening process for becoming SEALs. Whereas some, you know, you can, if you're an engineer at DuPont, you can pull engineers from Boeing and you can come through without starting at the bottom. But with the SEAL teams, it really does create a challenge organizationally because there's only one avenue to get in, right? That bottleneck choke point there.
No, absolutely. And so what happened was the story that I've heard is I think it was the CNO, Chief of Naval Operations, came to BUDS and said, you will fix this or I will fix this. And the SEALs said,
I've heard the same stories. Yeah.
We'll fix this. And so they launched a series of initiatives. I'll try to name some of them. One is Buds Prep, which is a physical preparation program after boot camp, but before Buds. For example, they will lift 35-pound weights over their heads, you know, numerous times in order to prepare for log PT, which is the same activity. They launched the Naval Special Warfare Recruiting Directorate, which is a weird hybrid organization. I don't know how they feel about their status today, but Navy recruiting's like, they're not recruiters. And they're like, we're not recruiters. Well, you got it in your title, guys. They're essentially recruiters and marketers. They go out, they drum up business. And then when they find people they like, they shepherd them over to Navy recruiting and say, this is a guy you want to take.
With a little bit of screening process on the front end, again, it's serving as an initial screening, and not only screening, but a cultivating, right? So I want to be a SEAL. Well, you haven't exercised in 6 months. You might want to rethink that. Here's a workout plan. Go and exercise some discipline as well as your physical capability, and then come back and see me in 6 months, and we'll start trying to prep you so that you have a greater chance of getting through, right?
Yeah, and they launched the Naval Special Warfare Recruiting Directorate owns SEALSWIC.com,
right,
which was a brilliant move. They basically put out the real information. So no more rumors, no more. This is how it is. This is how it is. They even have they have communities for people who I think are in the pipeline that maybe have been accepted into the DEP program. They can log in and it's private and they can start asking their questions. Great, great ideas. And all that's helped. And all that was designed around reducing turnover. Also, they at Navy Recruiting Command, they launched a special little group to run SEAL recruiting, SWIC recruiting, EOD recruiting, the rescue swimmer recruiting.
Rescue, Navy diver, what they called all of those specialty
skills. I think they called it the lunch program. Great name, right?
Yeah. Right.
Especially at Navy recruiting, where they don't have like cool things to do all the time. These are the guys. And you know what they were? Is they were a bunch of senior enlisted from those communities.
Yeah.
So there was like a SEAL master chief over there working with, I think, like a lieutenant commander recruiter. So part of that program, the recruiting program, because they're co-located with the organization I was with in Millington, is they asked us to help them a little late. They asked us to help them launch a screening test, which is called CSORT. And CSORT stands for Computerized Special Operations Resilience Test, which is a little bit poorly named. First of all, computerized. It's like, how are they like 1985?
Nothing gets you motivated by hearing a computerized test.
Right. And resilience, the reason that it's misnamed is because it's not just a test of resilience. And so eventually, later in my career with the SEALs, I was seen as the guy to ask about CSORT. And so I got a bunch of questions about, well, resilience is important, but I also think we should measure other things. And like, we're measuring other things. It's just the name of the test. So anyway, they launched CSORT as part of everything they were trying to do. And that's the screening test. So you were asking, you said people are always trying to figure out what is it we're looking for. Well, we figured it out, actually. I eventually, I'll tell you. We figured it out, though. And let me tell you about that 85%. So when all of these programs get launched, I didn't have all historical data. So data collection maturity was still occurring and is still probably occurring at BUDS.
Yeah.
So I had data going all the way back to 2009. And at this point, I think it was around 2012. So 2009 to 2012. 2009, we were not making enough SEALs. From recruiting standpoint, they were missing their goal. They weren't sending.
I think you mentioned like the CNO came, and I remember being in the teams, and this was around 2004, 2005, and he said, either you figured out or we'll figure it out. And we're like, okay, roger that. We'll get some great recruiting things. And I think in that first year, there was this like great vision that we were going to like just – somehow, again, you can't just pull them out of thin air. They have to go through BUDS. And we're like, we're not going to lower the standards in BUDS, but we'll just get more people. And I think what they found, this was 2004 or 2005, and we lost a lot of guys, unfortunately, in combat and and suicide, and just unfortunately, and guys just getting out. Guys had a great couple combat tours, 04, 05, and they're like, yeah, I'm good. I got shot at enough times. I'm good. So we had guys getting out, guys, you know, fortunately dying, and guys retiring, and they, and I think in, I want to say 06, 07, we had a net gain, including all of the guys that had come through from Buds, and we still had that, maybe we had a 15% graduation rate, but they put more people through, so we had a greater number. But because we had lost so many guys in that time frame, and I forget what year, but I think we had a net gain of one.
Wow.
At the end of the year, and maybe I'm confusing it, but there was a net gain of one. But yet we had brought in more guys, but we didn't account for retirees, guys getting out, you know, guys getting killed, and we had a net gain of one SEAL.
Wow.
at the end of the year. Not exactly hitting your goals.
No, absolutely not.
I'm sorry, sir. Please go ahead.
Yeah. So I had a unique position because I was trying to understand if the assessment was working. So at some point, what happened was I got brought in. I didn't design it. I didn't create it. I got brought in right before it turned on. And the ask of me was, hey, Josh, we're about to turn this on. All the other scientists have left. We knew that you had an interest in this project. Can you make sure that the programmer programmed it to match what the scientists want? And I took a look at it and I was disturbed, because I saw something that I felt wasn't the right way to program it. In other words, programming, check, he's doing it the right way. However, I disagreed with the scientists. And I was, you know, this is my first big opportunity to influence the Navy using my specialty.
Yeah.
And it's with the Navy SEALs. And I didn't know what to do. So I brought it to my leadership and they said, okay, got it, Josh, go present this to the client. It's their decision. So I go, I present it. I'm like, okay, going through it. You know, this is what's happening. I think we need to make this change.
The client being Naval Special Warfare Command.
No, at this point it was Navy Recruiting Command.
Got it. Okay.
So, but that's an interesting question, because here's what happened. The Navy Recruiting Command goes, Josh, I don't know you. I know those scientists that I worked with for a couple of years on this. I trust them. I don't trust you. Implement it the way they said. And I'm like, I'm devastated. I'm like, this is horrible. Like, I don't want to sign off on this. I mean, it's not like it was going to do bad things. It just wasn't going to do as much as it could. So we implement it, we turn it on. 3 months later, I changed my pitch. I go back to Navy Recruiting Command and I said, hey, remember I had some ideas for improvement. Would you be interested in exploring some of those? And you know what he said? And this is why I said that was a good question. He says, Josh, I worked on that project for like 3 years. Navy Recruiting Command has done their work. You want to do something more with that? Go talk to the SEALs. And I was like, great.
Yeah. Okay.
How do I do that? And so, you know, he did some introductions and I went out there, and that's a story as well. But it's, you know, the way the Navy business is done, you know this better than I do, having lived in it so many more years. But they have such a divided infrastructure that sometimes what's happening is, like, admirals don't like to play in other admirals' zones. And so I was in this unique position at a point where I was trying to prove that the assessment was working, CSORT was working, and I was trying to make a recommendation for an improvement. I had to analyze and track data from Navy Recruiting Command, the DEP program, Delayed Entry Program, RTC, Boot Camp, BUDS Prep, and then BUDS. Those are four different admirals. Well, yes, because BUDS Prep was run across the street. It was three or four different admirals. Nobody had put the big picture together of the data. So I'll tell you an interesting thing, that interesting lesson from a data standpoint, hey, is that
I don't like the implication here that the government was being inefficient. I don't really like what you're implying there.
So here's an interesting point that I learned from that lesson is, first of all, it was incredibly painful to pull all that data together. Nobody knew who to talk to. Nobody knew if I was allowed to have it and this and that. And then it was all structured differently. When you are the only person with the story, you get to tell the story. And so I got to tell the story of the success of all of these different programs. And I mapped it out over time as, you know, turnover was, you know, changing and things. Yeah. And then I actually quantified the part that the test was responsible for. The first time I presented that, people who represented the other stakeholder groups like Navy recruiting, Naval Special Warfare Recruiting Directorate were like, hey, well, we started doing activities in this year. And I'm like, okay, I need to figure out what everybody did.
Yeah.
So I can give credit.
Yeah. Everybody needs to get their pat on the back, right?
I mean, I wanted to say, well, go do your own analysis, buddy. That's not what I said. Instead, I did the analysis. So first of all, let me tell you that 85% attrition, I don't know what it is today, but here's what happened with CSORT. When CSORT was turned on, attrition did come down. And it came down by so much that I told them, they used to say 80%, 80%, 80%, 80%. Yeah. I said, it's not 80% anymore, guys, it's 70. Like it had been holding steady below 80. So I said, you need to start saying 70, stop saying 80. Well, I made some changes. Those changes started to have an effect. And let me tell you what happened with turnover. Turnover went, like I said, it was hovering like in like right around 70. Then it started coming down and down and down. It got all the way down to 50% for one class. And I warned them. So I need to tell you this story, but I warned them when we made the changes. I was like, look, guys, we're going to make some changes. The projection is turnover is going to come down. It's not. I had already learned enough about the SEAL culture that I wanted to warn them that it's not because things have low. We have.
I was
going to
say, as soon as you say that, when you say I'm warning them, I want you to finish the sentence. Warn them about what? Because I can tell you, I can tell what's coming.
Yes, that it's not that BUDS is easier. It's that we're getting better at picking people.
Oh, here we go. Some PhD nerd just lowered our standards. You know, exactly. I can tell you that's what was being said. As soon as you walked out, hey, Dr. Cotton, very good. Close the door. Hey, if this nerd lowers our standards, I'm going to come back. I'm going to choke him to death. That's exactly what was being said, right? So, yeah, I can appreciate a very challenging uphill battle to say, we haven't lowered the standards. We've improved the quality of the people coming in.
They did not hear my warning. They didn't hear my warning.
Imagine that.
So what happens is attrition starts coming down and it gets to 50. I think it was 52% for this one class. And they were like panicked. They were like, what broke? Something broke. You guys are screwing it up. And you know what happened? The cultural backlash happened and pushed essentially the standard up. And they were like, you will get quitters. You will get not leadership, but the SEAL community, probably the enlisted SEAL community, who were calling up the instructors and saying, you know, you got to do your job better, buddy. And so attrition came back up is what happened. But objective data, I knew this was roughly 2013. I could show them on record, like CSORT psychological data is still ambiguous to most people. Like they don't know what's a high, what's a low. Is that really a better person? I tell them it is. And they just like, you know, I don't believe you. What do SEAL instructors believe? Push-ups, runtime, sit-ups, pull-ups. They don't necessarily believe in the ASVAB, but that's another objective criteria. On all of the objective criterias, CSORT aside, we were sending the best applicants on record, and yet turnover was still like hovering similar levels. That just goes to show you that there wasn't a consistent standard.
So let me dive into this a little bit. And I think this is fascinating for any organization, and not just the SEALs, but for any organization saying, you just made a claim that I was sending the best applicants. And what the SEALs have struggled with, and I think organizations around the world struggle with, is we measure people according to what's on their resume. Oh, he's got an MBA or they have some great pedigree, or look at this job they did. But it's very hard to measure the qualitative skills. Like, what are your soft skills? Well, I'm a problem solver. Well, prove it. Well, I'm decisive. Well, prove it. You know, there's some qualitative stuff. And I think the SEALs in particular, but particularly other organizations, they struggle with the same thing. So when you say I'm sending the best qualified candidate, what were the criteria that gave you the confidence to be able to say, I'm sending the best. Besides an ASVAB score, which for those who are listening who don't know, that's essentially your SATs to get into the military, but a much easier test. But that's what it measures. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. It measures basic like academic skills. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So when you say I'm sending the best, best in what? In what categories and what gives you that confidence to say that?
Well, so, I mean, for me personally, sitting at my own computer talking to my colleagues, I had an algorithm. The algorithm combined their physical entry scores that got them the SEAL contract. So, by the way, this is mostly enlisted that I'm talking about. I had their ASVAB scores, and I used a portion of their ASVAB scores, which is most closely aligned with IQ, and I had their CSORT scores. And in combination, I had an overall predictive score. So I could determine that we are sending you guys, the SEALs, the people most likely to make it through BUDS, at least in prior years. So I knew that. I knew objectively that we were sending people who were far more likely to make it through. So I don't even need to understand it. I just know that the people who are like this end up performing like this, and this is what you guys want. And now let's say 6 out of 10, that's who I'm sending, and we used to send you 2 out of 10. Mm. Now I tried to prove it to them with the stuff that people, you know, cling to. I'll give you an example, pull-ups. So at the time, now I believe, last I checked, I mean, it's outdated information, but last I checked, the pull-up standard was minimum of 12. Well, at the time, the minimum was 10. If you got 10, you qualified for a SEAL contract. But like you said, they weren't taking everybody.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you the average at the time. This is when, you know, turnover still hanging right around 70. At the time, the average pull-ups for the guys that were arriving at BUDS was 19. That is so far above 10. I mean, I can't do probably 3 at this point. It's embarrassing, but 19s, that's a ton of pull-ups. And they weren't just good at pull-ups. They were good at push-ups and swim time and run time. I mean, they were in great, great shape. They were scoring well on the, you know, IQ portion of the ASVAB. And their personality traits, their competencies, their characteristics from CSORT were also aligning. But I also want to tell you what, because I haven't even shared this story yet, but.
You heard it here first, folks.
I had a question from a 2-star Navy SEAL admiral when I was presenting some of this information. I wanted to make the changes. Remember I said there was the room for improvement. He says, go out and talk to the SEALs. So let me tell you that story. I go out and talk to the SEALs and it went great. SEALs are freaking awesome. I at this point in my government career, I had spent about 3 years working with non-SEALs in big Navy, essentially. And it's a horrible place to work. And if you think the SEALs are inefficient, oh my gosh, the rest of the Navy is, a disaster. So I go out there and I meet with Captain Bill Wilson, at the time, the commanding officer of the Naval Special Warfare Center. Awesome guy. I don't know if you ever met him. Really love this dude. He is great, great leader. And I present to him ridiculous amount of information. I was too green, I think. I presented 50 slides in an hour. And he followed it all. I think there were 2 captains there at the time. He followed it all. And he goes, this is great. I think we should do it. And I want my boss to hear it. And I'm like, man, that's not a lot of pushback. There's not a lot of questions. Yeah. I think he had asked some questions while I was going through. He goes, but you can only have 10 slides. This is way too many. So I cut this deck down. And his boss is a 2-star Navy SEAL admiral, the commanding officer of Naval Special Warfare.
Yeah.
So this is my first, by the way, this is my first time doing any work with any SEAL. And
by the way, this is such a typical SEAL story. I've never done it. So we're not gonna let you sort of like get a toe wet. You're gonna go talk to the admiral on your second thing. By the way, you're only gonna have 1/5 of the amount of slides and 1/5 the amount of time. And go.
Yeah. So then we go into this, we have this private meeting with Admiral Winters was his name. Yep. You must have served under him in some capacity.
I know Ed Winters, yeah.
And it's a good name for him at the time because he's 2-star and, you know, very gray hair, and he's definitely an older guy. We go in and we sit at this round table, and I'm starting to go through some really complex information. Remember, I don't have all my slides anymore. So the reason I had so many slides was to make it simple and break it down and lead up to the complex. I couldn't do that anymore. And at some point during the conversation, he gets up and he goes to get coffee, and he's like, I'm still listening. And I'm like, is he? Because this is complicated. He gets the coffee, he comes back and sits back down. I'm like, I don't know what's going on here, right? Like, this is a 2-star admiral. Like, this should be way more formal. And he's like, this is great. We should do it. And he said, I want my whole team to hear about it. And then he goes, but you only get 2 slides. So I don't know what the obsession with cutting slides in, but I had no idea what he was saying.
It's efficiency, bud. That's all. We're just efficient.
So I believe it was a Monday.
Or maybe we like to see people sweat. Maybe that's the other thing.
It was a Monday when I presented to Captain Wilson. It was a Wednesday when I presented to Admiral Winters. And he was now inviting me to Friday's meeting with with his entire leadership team at the MAJCOM, the Major Commander's Brief. So I go to the MAJCOM, and I don't know what it is, right? And people start to funnel in, and some of them say hi to me, and they recognize me. And I'm like, at this point, you guys all look the same to me. Like, I don't know who I'm talking to. You probably know who attends it, but it was all the E9s or E8s and all of the O6s for all of the different Naval Special Warfare groups.
Yeah.
You know, DevGrew, I didn't know. I'm glad I didn't know because I would have been super nervous. They were on the VTC. There were some VTCs. I didn't know who was listening to what. And I present my 2 slides and talking about we're going to make some changes to the algorithm.
For anybody listening, VTC is military jargon for Zoom. We can't just call it a Zoom. We have to come up with an acronym, virtual teleconference, rather than just do like with the rest of the world, call it a Zoom. But right.
And so at some point in the conversation, and they all get it, they're all on board, especially because Admiral Sanso, one of the 2-star SEAL admirals. So here's what happens. Again, totally unprepared for this. The Admiral Winters is there. I knew he was going to be there, but also the 2-star who runs the East Coast was there, who was a reservist. I don't remember his name, but he's the one that asked me this question. And then the incoming 2-star to replace Winters was there. So there's 3 2-star SEAL admirals. I don't even know how many there are in the Navy. Can't be many more than 3.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot.
So they're all there. And the guy who runs the East Coast turns to me and he's like, okay, you know, he didn't say we get it, but he was on board. He liked it. He was in favor of it. And remember, I'm warning them. We're going to change the math, you guys more qualified people. Attrition's going to come down. It's not broken. This is when I was warning them and they didn't listen. But he says, okay, you've been looking at the data. You've been studying the profiles. What is it we're looking for? And at that point in the project, I had not answered that question. I literally had been doing the math. So I had been tinkering with the math and the algorithms. I didn't know what it meant. Yeah. And I fumbled around with my answer. And then the Captain Wilson wisely cut me off and said,
Wait, just to be clear, they were asking you to define the ideal candidate. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
From a psychological standpoint, I think. Yes.
Yeah. Who is he?
Yes. Because... And he introduced his, I can't believe I even remember this scene so clearly, but he introduced his question with, this is something we've talked about for a long time.
It is.
You
right?
said it too. And it had. And by the way, they continued to talk about it even after he asked me this question, and I feel like later I answered it. They continued to ask it, and they continued to launch projects. Well, so so the captain interrupts me and says, we're not... He doesn't have that answer for you today, sir, but we'll get that answer and get back to you. And I was like, oh, thank goodness. That's a good response. Now I know what to say to some senior leader the next time he asks me something I don't know. It's I don't know, but I'll find out. So I set out to answer that question. And I launched a project. That's when things really got fun. Well, first of all, that week was super fun. But then it really got fun because I was I had this opportunity. Nothing was broken. Wasn't some big problem I had to fix. Can I improve what we're doing? And can I explain it so that maybe we can be better at searching? So I start studying what I think it takes to make it through BUDS. So who are the people who make it past Hell Week? First of all, I studied all the attrition spikes. I know that attrition spikes right when they get out there, essentially. The first week after basic orientation, attrition spikes, because the instructors call it a kick in the teeth. They kick them in the teeth on purpose, not literally. And then attrition spikes again right during Hell Week. Of course, during Hell Week, which I got to observe, you unfortunately had to participate in.
I got to observe it, just a different lens. You? But I got to, well, I mean, from inside.
Yeah. I'm sure it's a quite different experience.
That's different. I mean, it's still an observation. It's a clinical observation.
I literally was like, this is not humanly possible what these people are doing right now. And they're doing it. And I'm like,
and the instructors are laughing.
Oh yeah. Instructors are like, yeah, whatever. They're fine. This is great. Like, no, twice, do it again.
Yeah. No, his core body temperature is literally 10 degrees lower than it should be. That'll be fine.
They're like, good. That'll make him tough.
Then it's working.
So here's what ended up happening. I was thinking, hey, maybe I can build a better algorithm. Maybe I can help people figure out what to recruit for. But then I started saying, oh, wow, I feel like there's big missing pieces in this assessment. I can't believe it. I'll give you one example. And this is because of the state of my industry at the time. But just one example. You guys refer to your workplace as the teams,
yeah,
right? Being part of the SEALs as the teams. People would talk about, you know, when I was with the teams or everything at BUDS, you've got the swim buddy, but then you have the boat crews. Mm-hmm. Everything is done in groups and teams in the SEALs, and nothing in the psychological assessment was designed to predict how somebody will perform in a team. Do they have a team mindset? Are they going to do well in a team environment? And I'm like, that's a miss. And anyway, I found a series of misses, and I was going to build a C-sort 2, solving a problem that didn't exist. But by the time I got that close, I was on my way out. Yeah. So I decided to build that assessment on my own, because I also thought about, what's the point of doing all of this work for this very tiny little problem that doesn't even really exist in this one environment, naval special warfare, or maybe it could be applied to the Army. They probably wouldn't, because they just won't accept something that's coming from the Navy. The Marines would probably take it because, you know, they don't have a lot of resources, so they'll take whatever.
Right.
Air Force would maybe have been open to it. So anyway, I decided that there's a bigger problem I can solve, which is taking this same information that I learned, but applying it to all jobs, all people, all professionals. And so what I did was I constructed my own assessment that I call the Elite Performance Indicator, and it's available at epitesting.com. And the concept there was to design an assessment that measures all the things that should have been in C-sort, that are in C-sort, but that all the things that truly matter. So what is it, not just what is it about the type of guy that can make it through BUDS, but what is it that enables SEALs to be successful? So what that two-star SEAL asked me, what should we be looking for? Now I can answer the question. I'll give you some examples. You should be looking, and this is too high level, but you should be looking for somebody with good leadership, somebody who is good at working in a team. You should be looking for somebody who is resilient, of course. I already knew that one. You should be looking for somebody who is driven. Let me stop you there for a second.
To say that you should be looking for somebody with good leadership, somebody who works on a team, those are so nebulous that any organization, whether it's whether it's McDonald's or SpaceX, they want people who have good leadership skills. They want people who work well on a team. There's not an employer on the planet that says, no, working well on a team is not important to me, right? It's, yes, I need somebody who works well on a team. So what in that, how do you find, and not just in your study of the SEALs, but how do you define works well in a team, and how do you measure it? How do you define has good leadership, and how are you measuring that?
Well, so two points. Actually, the first one is totally agree with you. Every organization should say, I would like somebody with good leadership skills who can work well in a team, right? Yeah. But guess what? They don't screen for that.
Right. Whether they want it and whether they actually screen for that are two different things. And that's an interesting point you bring up, right? They say that, and they even say like, well, we have interview questions that help us figure out whether if he doesn't answer correctly, then we know he's not a good leader. But is that, I guess my question to you is that accurate?
Well, that would be a step in the right direction. Most interviews, though, are not structured. Most interviews are some manager sitting down with a resume, reading it, and asking questions that he or she feels are important.
More conversational than structured, you'd say.
Yeah. So if they had a leadership question, I'd say, okay, at least you're measuring it. And I'd be okay with that. I mean, it's not the best thing in the world. But if they had it, and if they had a teamwork question, I'd be okay with that too. Most of them just don't, because there's a huge flaw in the screening process. And I made this discovery at this point in my project with the SEALs, understanding team measurement and team prediction. It's this giant, giant gaping hole, which is we screen an individual for an individual job. And then when we hire them, we put them in a group. And we didn't do anything to measure the dynamics of the group or how are they going to work in a group. Yeah. Best thing we get at is communication skills, which we think we're testing during the interview. And I don't like interviews being a test of anything. I try to tell managers that an interview is a data collection opportunity. You're just there to collect data about all these different aspects. You're not supposed to, I don't think you should judge an applicant based on if they were 5 minutes late or did they have trouble answering question three. I feel like it's the interviewer's job to make that person give their best information to question number three. Because people misunderstand, people walk in and they treat an interview like a test. And they're like, you know, I'm supposed to read you 9 questions during a structured interview.
Yeah.
They're like, I read him question 7. He didn't understand. Did you hear that answer? Look, if he's thought you said something else, that's your fault. You need to stop him and say, well, okay, what about projects like X? Oh, you meant projects X. Yeah, okay, I'll answer that question for you. So if they've got a leadership question, I'd be okay with that in a teamwork, but I have it on my assessment. Now, you are 100% right. It's too nebulous, too high level. I defined leadership as a hybrid of what does the research literature say you should be measuring in combination with what I was seeing in special operations as successful leaders. Like one example, my leadership scale has a dimension in it about, are you willing to step up and be a leader? So it's not necessarily, because that's what I saw in the SEALs. I saw everybody ready to be in charge. Everybody's ready to be in charge, right? And you put 5 SEALs in the room.
It's built into our ethos, right? In the absence of leadership, I will take charge and lead my men, right? That's written into the ethos.
It's 100% true. If the leader isn't present at a meeting, somebody's going to take over. That's a unique, you're both a leader and a follower. I mean, that's tough. But so that's in my brand. Servant leadership's in my brand of leadership. But I agree with you, it's very nebulous. And I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people who try to define it. The other thing with teamwork is the same. But there are aspects of teamwork that you can measure that are predictive. I'll give you a couple of them.
Yeah, please.
One is something called preference for teamwork. And it's pretty simple, but it's shown to be very predictive, which is, do you like it? Do you like working in teams? People will say, no, I don't. Well, guess what? They're not as good. That's why they don't like it. They don't like it because they're not as good at it. And that's okay. You know, if your job is a high team environment, which by the way, most civilian organizations aren't, they don't know that. But if you feel like it's high, then you need to look for the people who want to be there. One of the other most predictive, and this was part of my dissertation, is willingness to put the needs of the team above your own. And now that's got to speak to you as a SEAL, because that's essentially what SEALs do. right?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that's drilled in from day one, not only just when you're running around in buds, but even when you get to your team and you come off of an operation and you're filthy and you're covered in sand and dirt and you're soaking wet, there's a rule that goes team gear, personal gear, then self. And that's the order in which you will take care of items. So you are soaking wet, you're dirty and covered in, but you will first take your diving rig, or you'll take your parachute, or you'll take your weapon, and you'll take care of the team gear. And then you take care of your personal gear, which is, you know, whatever your radio that you had on yourself or something like that. Or and then you'll take care of your personal gear. Maybe your weapon would second, and the first, the team gear would be the Humvees or something. You'll take care of those, spray them off, clean them off, and take care of the team gear. Then your personal gear, which would be your weapon, your radio. Then when you're done with that, then you take care of yourself. And it's just, it's ingrained. And it's funny, I talk to a lot of SEALs, and we manage our kids that way. We parent that way. We'll come back in and we'll come back from the grocery store and they'll want to run in to the house and do whatever, take their backpacks. I'm like, team gear first, which means the groceries come out, then personal gear. And before you get on your iPad or go take care of yourself or whatever, you're going to take care of hanging your backpack. And it's a team gear, personal gear, self approach. And you're right. There's some things, some habits you just don't leave behind.
Well, so tell me in your experience, what happens if you're working in a team and one of those guys is clearly self-focused?
Whew, that's a tough one.
Have you seen that happen? Have you seen somebody?
There's things that are done that we can edit out of here. But
no, you don't have to give me the real story.
I'm kidding.
Bad things, right? I mean, bad things happen when one person in a team is focused on themselves and not the mission, not the team.
And I was speaking in jest when I said that, but there are a couple things that happen. Is one, we are not, and being on the civilian side now and still having one toe in the water with the reserves, but dealing with civilian teams and leadership consultant helping civilian teams, I've tried to help them find a much more measured approach to what we took. But we very plainly publicly shamed people. And when I say publicly, I mean within the organization or within that small team. There was no reluctance to call somebody out for being a shithead and doing something that was egregious or just demonstrated a lack of concern or a lack of ability to think ahead. And it is a very tough environment. It is not an empathetic environment. So it doesn't work very well, and it doesn't have a great translation to all other organizations. But there are organizations that can, to my non-scientific assessment, is there are organizations that can take a piece of that and say that peer pressure has a tremendous effect. Now, we live in a world where shaming isn't really favored as a means of getting somebody to change, but in a much more rough and tumble environment, it was very effective. And you built thick skin. You learned to laugh at your own inadequacies and things like that. So it does have some application how civilian organizations use a scaled down approach to that. I haven't cracked that nut yet.
But I mean, why did you guys take it so seriously? Like, what was the reason that it was taken seriously?
I think people listening would go, oh, because it's life and death, because one small mistake could cost somebody their life. It really wasn't that. It was because we had an expectation that when you are at work, and really all times, but when you're at work, there is never a time where you will concede to giving 99%. And if you are giving 100%, you can still make mistakes if you were giving it your all. But if your mistake was because of negligence, because your brain wasn't turned on, or because you weren't able to control your emotions, like we put ourselves in very high stress situations when we're talking about doing like what the world might know as like SWAT team maneuvers, doing what we call close quarters combat, very high stress. We don't when we train for, you know, what the world would know as SWAT maneuvers, like, you know, doing entry into a simulated bad guy's house. And when we train for that, when we go out for that training block, you are expected to be able to perform under a very high stress situations on day two. So we go out and we do about 2, maybe 3 days of training with what we have, these paint simunitions, or paint munitions. And on day one, they put you in pretty high stress situations. Day two, day three, they ramp it up very quickly. By day four, you're going to go in and you're going to make entry into a simulated terrorist hideout with live ammunition. And the guy you're going in right behind another guy with a gun that has live bullets that could kill somebody. And the guy coming behind you has the same thing. So everybody is expected to, in day one, two, and three, to meet the standard of rapidly increasing intensity, stress. It's really that mental demand. It's really not the physical demand. It's the mental demand. Can you meet that mental demand? And then on day four, we're going in with live ammo. And one small mistake, it's not just that it could kill somebody. It's that you didn't bring 100% to that. And if you allow yourself to slip and give 80% in this or 80% in that, then you're not designed for the environments, particularly when if you look at like a Marcus Luttrell situation, he survived in that, and all four of them performed so honorably and incredibly because there was no surrender. There was no acceptance to give 80%. Even when Marcus was, you know, had lost his three teammates and he was in a very dire situation, there was never an option to quit. You could only give 100% because there is no other option.
So, you know, even though you said it's not life and death, it really is that. It's just what you were describing from my evaluation is that it never gets that far, because what you guys have is a very strong culture. Mm-hmm. And you have these very strong norms, and you guys know what they are. And so it's always natural for any group to enforce norms. Everybody can think back to high school, and whatever group you're a part of, doesn't matter, you guys dressed a certain way. And if you decided to dress the style of a totally different social group, your friends would ridicule you. That's norm enforcement. Yes. It's the same thing. So what you were describing, it's actually interesting. It certainly would if you guys didn't enforce it at every moment, at the first moment you see it, whether it's just putting your gear away, it would eventually seep into the missions and then people would die. So it really is life or death. It's just you guys are really good at catching it early and enforcing it, which, by the way, you're bringing up another aspect. One of the aspects, my definition of drive, which is different, I think, than others, has to do with the fact that what I discovered about SEALs and high performers, period. That's the other thing, is this assessment isn't built necessarily just to find like a SEAL or somebody. That's too small of an application. It's built to understand who can be successful, period. Because SEALs are, you're a good example. You work in the civilian world and, you know, the military, you're a great example of being successful in both environments. People have misunderstandings about SEALs and think, oh, you're only good at like shooting things. No, they're good at overcoming stress, adapting, like we said, leadership, stepping up, enforcing rules. All those things contribute to companies being successful. Well, what I discovered, because here's a big question that was being asked, which is, and I asked it, but I would ask all of these students and I would ask SEALs, I was like, why did you sign up? Why did you decide to do this? And, you know, people have various answers, and I wasn't really looking for the, although it was, you know, always heartwarming to hear things, you know, patriotic and things. I was trying to understand, why did you sign up as a human? We are wired to survive. Why would you willingly put yourself in a position where it's highly likely, it may not happen, but it's highly likely somebody's going to shoot at you to try to kill you. You volunteered for that. It's counterintuitive from a human perspective. And that's the stuff I was trying to get at. And as it turns out, here's what I discovered. It's because the people who make it through BUDS want to be better. That's who they are. They're people who want to grow and be better. And I started to hear that when somebody said to me, it was a E9, and he said, because it's the hardest thing I could think of. And I'm like, that's weird. Who, most Americans structure their lives so that they're easy. This whole concept of like get to retirement and go boating, bad plan. That's a bad plan. Research actually shows that health declines when people go from being really productive members of society to all of a sudden they're golfing all the time. Yeah. Like that's not good for you. That shouldn't be our idea.
Although I will tell you that I actually want to get there, and then I will confirm or refute your data. Your data.
As long as you're volunteering with organizations where you can give back, that's fine. Right. It just you're not gonna be happy. Maybe you'll be happy golfing for 3 months in a row or something, but eventually you'll regret it, right? I mean, actually, look at the example of guys who get out of the military and fully retire, start putting on weight. They all grow their beards because they're like, yeah, I can grow my beard. But then they all put on weight. and some of them go back and lose it. But so what I discovered is what they're really doing is they figured out earlier in life that if you seek out challenges, you grow. It's like working out. If you lift weights, then you always know that if you've lifted weights for a long period of time, you know that you eventually have to lift heavier weights, right? What if you did the opposite? What if you went into the gym and you bench pressed like 200 pounds 10 times today, and tomorrow you went in and bench pressed 100 pounds 10 times? Why would you do that? You're not going to grow that way. It's not bad for you, but you're not going to grow. You're not going to get as good of a workout. And so apply that to your own life. If you're not seeking out challenges, if you're not responding to the bad news of life with, hey, this is my opportunity to learn and grow, you're stressing yourself out and you're viewing life, I think, in a dark way. You're viewing life in the victim mentality, which your listeners probably aren't like that, but you're viewing life in the it's coming at me. And SEALs don't view life as it's coming at me. They view life as I'm coming at life.
So if one of the hallmarks of what makes you through buds, and I think there's, not to use a broad generalization, but if that's applicable for any employer to say, hey, this is a skill set or this is a character trait that we found in SEALs or SEAL candidates that made them ultimately successful, is a desire to take on challenges because they recognize that a challenge resulted in growth. How does an employer screen for that?
Well, epitesting.com.
There we go. I like it.
But
you're welcome. I mean, you're welcome. I just teed that one up for you.
beyond, you know, the easy button using my assessment, it'd be a complex set of, I think, interview questions. But people rarely, this is what I tell people, broadly speaking, when I'm coaching them on what they should be doing in a screening process, is you need to look for, and I didn't invent this, I was taught this by a professor, and then I saw it with the SEALs. You need to look for a pattern of somebody who's accomplishing and accomplishing and accomplishing. So sometimes, you know, not every job gives you that opportunity, so you have to take that into account. But in general, people who are like, you know, doing twice as much as everybody else, again and again and again, fix this problem, fix that problem, outside my duties. Another way you can see it sometimes, like, maybe if you're looking at somebody's schooling, is there extra activities? So I was captain of the football team and I got, you know, like a B average. Like, that's great. You're really accomplishing in two zones here. But that's what you need to look for, is not people who interview well. You need to look for the people who accomplish and they want to accomplish. I'm trying not to just speak for myself, but for me, what drives me is impact. I can get at impact a whole lot of different ways. You know, I've got a particular career field where I'm trying to impact. But as you mentioned, like working with veterans, that's a passion of mine that I have to almost keep away from me like an addiction, because otherwise that's all I'll do. And all of it's always been volunteer work, because I see a problem and I am passionate about making positive impact. And it's a situation where nobody loses if I can fix it, but I'm best at fixing it on a one-on-one basis. And that's just eats up all of my time. So I have done interviews and wrote some articles on coaching veterans in navigating the screening process. But I'm driven by impact. I had to learn from the SEALs to pursue growth. And so environments where supervisors give me, you know, constructive criticism about the things I'm doing wrong, again, civilian organizations are so bad at so many things, including giving feedback. The only time you ever get feedback is things that you're doing wrong.
Yeah, right.
And it's often not that helpful. Like now you just know that they don't like it when I do X. But I respond to that now well. And I ask them follow-ups. And I'm like, well, when did you see that? You know, I don't argue with them about it. I'm like, because regardless of how I feel, you know, that I did it well, this is their perception. And their perception matters. And it probably matches other people's perceptions. I learned that from the SEALs. And I'll give you the point at which I first saw it. It was Hell Week. And boat crews were doing rock portage. Remember that one? Oh my gosh. I don't know how you guys do that.
For those of you who don't know, on your very first night, so Sunday, but Hell Week starts on Sunday. Sunday night, you go out with your paddle boats there. Your inflatable boats, you paddle, and they make you come up, ride the waves in and crash up onto these pretty jagged rocks. And you have to be able to get a very heavy boat and all of your people out safely. And they do it on Sunday night because by Monday and Tuesday, you've been up for three days now,
tired.
And you're a little exhausted and your brain's kind of in outer space a little bit. But on Sunday night, you've been up for 12 hours, going at it straight 12 hours, just getting hammered, you know, on your physical training and stuff like that. And getting wet and cold and sandy, and then it is a very, very tough test because the waves are crashing, especially in the Pacific, and you're crashing onto these rocks, and you have to get your boat, all the people safely up onto the rocks, get your boat up onto the rocks, and then go do it again and over for several hours.
Yeah, and anybody who's ever been in a canoe or a rowboat and stepped out onto the dock, it's actually not that easy. This is like 1,000 times harder. And the water's moving and it's cold and you're under pressure and only one boat crew will do it at a time. So the rest of them just have to sit and wait. And anyway, so what I saw was, because everything at Buds is a race. So the first team to make it out won. And so the first team makes it out and they're sitting and waiting and they're waiting for the next teams and they're waiting for the next teams. And eventually, as things are going on in the night, the instructors I see take the first team and move them off, and then they surround them and they're yelling at them. And I say to the guy I was with, the command psychologist, and I said, wait a minute, I thought everything at Buds is a race. He's like, it is. Well, I said, they were the first, so they won. And I was like, well, you know, why are they yelling at him? Like, that's messed up. And he's like, that's the prize. And I was like, what the hell is wrong with this place? Until I realized the prize is feedback, how they can be better. They're getting the instruction. And it might be in the form of being yelled at what you did wrong, but that being, it's such a great attitude. And like I said, I tried to adopt it in my own life, and it's been such a huge stress relief. Because most of us, again, we go through life trying to make ourselves, make everything as easy as possible. You can't do that. You cannot control COVID. You cannot control the world. Bad news comes. Bad, you know, things break, whatever. And if you respond to it as, I'm going to learn how to do this, so the next time I'm faster at it, or maybe I can tell my friends how to do this, you start eating life for breakfast. You start eating challenges. It literally turns it into a challenge, not bad news, not a crisis.
I want to, before we shift gears, because there's a couple other things I do want to talk to you about. Before we shift gears, I want to ask you, because you brought up something that's always been something I've argued for and had very, you know, intellectual debates with friends and colleagues about for a long time. And I think there's still an element of it today. The screening process to go to Buds. And I ask this question because a lot of application to the civilian workforce and employers and HR folks and startups can learn from this, I think. But for a long time, it was, if you applied to Buds, and this was back when I came in the 90s and early 2000s, if you applied to Buds, you got in. That was it. We gave you a chance. As long as you weren't crazy and you could do the minimum number of pushups, you got in. And you mentioned 10 pushups or 12.
Yep.
If you could do the minimum, you got a slot because we had more
10
slots. We had more slots available.
Pushups were probably 40 or something.
Yeah. Sorry. Pull-ups. But we had more slots available than we had applicant or qualified applicant. So if you applied and you could pass the minimum standards, you could get in and then you were tested. Today, the standard is, as you said, 19. The minimum standard is 10 or 12, whatever it is, doesn't matter, to even be considered to be competitive for one of those very limited spots. To be competitive, you have to be able to do 19, and that's the minimum, right? And that's to even have your name be considered, and they look at all the other factors. one of the what I think is the downfalls of that is that we look at a very finite set of qualifications, and that's your physical capability, ability to do, to run fast, to swim fast, to lift your body vertically up on a bar, to push your body off the ground and with push-ups. And we're looking at a very finite skill set. Some of the greatest, the most resilient warriors that I ever worked with were guys that Hollywood would never cast as a SEAL. They were the guys who were who finished buds and still had a little bit of a belly on them. And I don't mean like a giant beer belly, but just their rare, DNA. Their DNA was not cut. Well, they were just the thick guys, or they were guys who were super skinny and could, you know, and couldn't, and were not push-up machines. And what I always argued was there were guys, and there's a, and I've said that I've told this story on the podcast before. One of my great buddies who will remain nameless, he had a background where he went through such childhood trauma that he was the most resilient, unbreakable human being I've ever met in my life. Would he have gotten into buds today? I doubt it. He was not a push-up machine. He was not a runner. He was not a great swimmer. He was obviously, by bud standards, he was not great. By civilian standards, he was outstanding. But by bud standards, he would never even had his name thrown into the hat. And so my question is, when we only look, if the today's standard is, wow, we really have guys who have a high IQ, and because we tested them on the ASVAB, and they can do the higher standard of push-ups and pull-ups and things like that, are we missing an opportunity to assess people for that thing inside that all employers want, that heart, that tenacity? Does your assessment give insight into that, or is there another way? Are we selling ourselves short by not looking at that component of somebody's makeup?
Well, yeah. So actually, that's what CSORT was designed essentially to fill the gap for. So it does tap into things like that. It does tap into resilience and those aspects of the mental side of performing at BUDS. And yes, my assessment does as well. In fact, it's funny you would mention tenacity. I actually distinguish resilience from tenacity. So for me, resilience is your bounce back. Talking about bad news. So, you know, you get a big bill in the mail, you open it up and you're like, oh no, that's not good. Are you upset for like 5 days? Okay, well, that's not resilience. Are you upset for 5 seconds? That's resilience. It's your bounce back. Yeah. Bounce back doesn't necessarily mean you're going to stick with something. And so that's what I call tenacity. Tenacity to me is the person who grips on and they hold on. Now, you kind of have to have resilience to have tenacity.
Sure. But they're very complimentary for sure.
Yes, yes. But for me, resilience can be independent. And as you mentioned earlier, it's something that can be worked on. Both of them are. Resilience is harder, I think, to work on than tenacity is, but they can both be worked on and improved. Now, in terms of how do employers look for it and do SEALs look for it? So there's kind of two elements in there. One is, of course, you know, you need to use a psychological assessment to get at psychological factors. I tell people you can get at this information another way, but not in 30 minutes. Not online, 30 minutes at the applicant's convenience. It's a very effective way to get at that. It's sometimes wrong. All assessments and all screening processes are sometimes wrong, even if they're well designed and you've got your algorithms. The reason for that is humans are hard to predict. We are really complicated. We surprise ourselves. So if we surprise ourselves, we surprise our spouses. If we surprise our spouses, we surprise our employers. So we surprise the marketers, right? They don't know exactly what's going to get us to buy, but they know more times than not. And so it works more times than not. But one of the points you brought up was this thing if you think about these minimums, what's happening, lots of employers do that. I call it the checkbox approach. Must have a bachelor's degree. Yeah. Must have 5 years experience in something. Must be from this city. Whatever it is, those are checkboxes. That's a bad way to evaluate people. We are far too complicated. Like, I'll give you an example, a bachelor's degree. The reason people look for it is because what they really want is they want the tenacity and the resilience. They want somebody who's going to stick with something. Mm-hmm. They want somebody who's reasonably intelligent. And maybe they want somebody who can write. None of that, you can have all of that and not have a bachelor's degree. So you're right. So checkboxes does make you miss out, I think. And it narrows the aperture. The more this, now I like to use dating as an example. The more things you have on your list for must-haves for that person, the less likely you are to find somebody. Because, you know, they might have, let's say you've got five. They might have four, but not the fifth. Or three, they might be really great at three, and then two, they suck at it. It's horrible. That's what people are like. I describe it as people are a collection of highs and lows. So what you really want, especially now I'm talking about algorithms like 10 times, but in an algorithm that's designed properly, what you have is something that in my field we call a compensatory model. And it means what it sounds like. You can compensate. So you score high over here, but low over here. It's okay, because together, that's the standard.
Yeah.
That's how you have to judge people, because we're so complicated. People who narrow it down to, I want, you know, people who worked at IBM are great at this organization. Ridiculous. That's ridiculous. That's a checkbox. You have no idea. IBM's a complicated environment, just like here. You don't know everything about a person. Now, I'll set all that aside.
Do you think, and we do that unconsciously, you're saying? Or obviously organizations do it.
100%. You know why we do it?
Ask my wife. I bet you my wife, if I asked her, like, does not have a lot of money, not that intelligent, kind of funny, in moderate shape. They balanced each other out. She's like, well, I guess I'll marry him.
Well, so no, what we actually do is that is unusual. Evaluating people holistically is unusual. And probably women are actually better at that than men, because we're serial processors and women are more holistic viewers. But we do it because we make our lives simple that way. I'll give you an example about voting behavior. So what, and I'm not an expert at voting research, but the
time is very timely.
It's exactly the times right now. People tend to, in the end, they vote on like one, two or three issues. These candidates put out these platforms with all these different, you know, programs they want to do. Well, guess what? The voters don't like all of those things, even the ones that voted for them. And they end up making their decision most often, probably on party, right? Yeah. One thing. They could say nothing. They could go in the debates and they could say nothing. People would still vote for them because they're their party. So we try to boil everything down to one or two things. Every time I hear somebody say that, like it's this one thing, I'm like, you're not taking the time. I don't know what the subject is, but you're not taking the time, man. You're not being a leader, especially in an organization. And I'll tell you, when they do it in organizations, and it's in our book, The Talent War, is when they say, you know what my solution is here? I need to fire that guy. It's like, I would say that leader is not taking the time. What they're doing is they're blaming their problems on this person. And it's a one thing. It's a one thing problem that can be solved by one thing, replace that one guy. What they're not looking at is, why did I hire him in the first place? Yeah. Was he qualified? Probably, because you hired him. So what led to his downfall? And if you don't study that and think about that, you're going to repeat it. You're going to hire the next guy who maybe looks like the opposite of that one, right? I think that happens in dating too. They're like, oh, that relationship didn't work out. So I'm going to this other extreme over here. And that doesn't work out either, because that person's probably not thinking about, how am I contributing to the problem of this relationship and fixing it? So it's never one thing when you're talking about people. It's always more complicated.
Hey, we are, we've been talking a long time, and I, first of all, it's a fascinating discussion, but you brought up The Talent War. Your new book just came out a couple days ago, came out on the Marine Corps birthday, 245th birthday, I believe, right?
Correct.
And so give us a quick synopsis, or have we really gotten a little bit of insight into what the talent war is about in this discussion?
We've gotten into some of it, yes. Not as in depth. We don't go as in depth into all the content that I've been discussing. Because of the audience, we were trying to reach a broad audience, leaders in small, medium sized businesses. Of course, it's applicable to larger organizations as well. It's essentially using special operations as the core example of what can be done well with people, whether it's hiring them, retaining them, attracting them. And then there's civilian organizations that are looked at both favorably and unfavorably. Like unfavorable would be an Enron, and how Enron claimed that they looked for ethics when they were screening people, and that they're one of the most unethical organizations. Right. So it's a mixture of that. We conducted a lot of interviews. I don't know exactly the total number in the end. Maybe it was 20, but we spoke to people who knew or who had worked in special operations in the screening side. So most of them were veterans, and we talked to people in the civilian world, heads of HR, the CEO of 7-Eleven. And combining all this information is what you find in the book. So it's not always as clear, like, where the information's coming from. Doesn't matter. I don't think readers even care about that stuff. I do as a researcher, because, like, I'm ingrained that you're supposed to attribute all the time, right? But, right. You know, readers don't care. It's very easy to read. It's very well written. That was a lot of work. But it talks really about how to hire, how to attract, how to retain from the standpoint of focusing on people. And that's, again, not what we're doing when we look at a checkbox. If I'm looking at a checkbox, I'm focusing on attributes. And I don't mean attributes in the psychological sense. I mean these must-haves. And the reason I think that I can evaluate people on the must-haves is because I'm not thinking about the person. I'm not thinking about them as a person anyway if I'm looking for 5 criteria. I'm thinking about it as a commodity. And when I fire them to fix my problem, I'm thinking about them as a commodity. And if that's how you're thinking about your people, they're going to act like commodities. And they're going to say, you know what? I can get a better price over here. I'm going to walk my commodity to that store. And that's what they do. You need to treat people like people. You need to evaluate people like people. And it's possible. And it's the book tries to help you reframe and think a little different about how you're approaching things. And we try to really sell you on, persuade you on, convince you on why that's a good thing and why it works. Like, ethics is in the book, for example. And that was when I say this, I'm not trying to say that this was only my idea, but that was a major contribution I made, was putting a discussion of ethics in the book. And the reason I put that in is because my fascination with SEALs, studying SEALs, and I'm learning, you know, aggressive warriors, you know, ready to fight, ready to work, you know, all these things. It's like, why are they not, like, going off the rails all the time? And I know that that happens sometimes, but why isn't it all the time? And it's because of the norms, like you said. It's because you guys have these standards, and they're important to you. They're important to the community. And you've worked in civilian organizations, right?
Yeah.
They don't have strong cultures. They don't have these standards that get enforced very often. And so I saw that as a big difference. And so we talk about ethics as a standard, a good one, that has to form the box that keeps your super aggressive performer looking out for everybody, looking out for the organization, not trying to do anything that would harm any others, that type of thing. And because if you take that away, they're just going to go free. And they're going to go free to a bad place, and it's going to end up in Enron. Enron was probably, you know, capable people that led to that, who just weren't being held accountable. So you got to hold people accountable, and ethics is a good, you know, good standard, good way to think about holding people accountable for good things.
The book is The Talent War. It's on Amazon. It's on wherever you buy your major books. Josh, it is Josh Cotton.
Dr. Josh Cotton
on LinkedIn, if people want to connect with you, right?
Absolutely.
And it is eliteindicator.com, where they can find, they can look at your elite performance indicator assessment tool, right?
Go to epitesting.com.
epitesting.com.
That's my favorite. That's my new slicker website, epitesting.com.
Got it. epitesting.com for the elite performance indicator testing assessment and personality assessment tool. And Dr. Josh Cotton on LinkedIn, if people want to connect with you. Did I miss anything?
No, I think that's good. Thanks, you can Google me too. If you Google, this is so cool. If you Google Josh Cotton, PhD, you'll probably get me. But if you Google Josh Cotton, PhD, Navy SEAL, it's not, I'm not a SEAL, but you'll find me as well. That's pretty cool, right? I'm not a SEAL, but if you, I'm associated with those words. Those are good words to be
associated. Yeah, it's good words to be associated with, right? Yeah. Hey, Josh, thank you so much for joining us, brother. We appreciate it, man. We'd love to have you back on because I think it's a really fascinating topic. And I know you did other things. You were on the, you were on the Naval Special, I wrote this down, Naval Special Warfare Women in Research Women in Service Research Group.
It was, yes. Before the military decided to allow women into special operations.
Yeah, that's a topic for another time, man. But it's just, I mean, it's such a fascinating look at equality issues and what you saw from your research and in an organization that is, you know, historically only been male. So it'd be curious to just, it'd be a great, fascinating topic that we'd want to get into and just and dig a little bit more into your research. But hey, man, thanks so much for your time and thanks for your insights. Really, really fascinating story.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. Really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Green Castle Podcast. Please be sure to give us a like, a thumbs up, a share. You can find us at greencastleconsulting.com/podcast or on all the major podcast channels and the social media channels, including our YouTube channel. Thanks very much. We'll see you on the next episode.